Chapter 10. The Most Expensive Drug Ever Sold. Generics, AIDS, and AZT. When Estes Kefauver died in 1963, he was writing a book about monopoly power called In a Few Hands. Early into Reagan's first term, the industry must have been tempted to publish a gloating retort titled In a Few Years. Between 1979 and 1981, the drug companies did more than break the stalemate of the 1960s and 70s. They smashed it wide open. Stevenson Wilder and By Doyle replaced the Kennedy policy with a functioning framework for the high-speed transfer of public science into private hands. As the full machinery was built out, the industry-funded echo chamber piped a constant flow of memes into the culture. Patents alone drive innovation. R&D requires monopoly pricing. Progress and American competitiveness depend on it. There is no other way. In December 1981, the drug companies celebrated another long-sought victory when Congress created a federal court devoted to settling patent disputes. Previously, patent disputes were heard in the districts where they originated. The problem, from industry's perspective, was the presence of so many staunch New Deal judges in key regions like New York's Second Circuit. These lifetime judges often understood patent challenges not as threats to property rights, but as opportunities to enforce antitrust law. Local circuit judges appointed by Republicans could also be dangerously old-fashioned in their interpretations of the novelty standard. By contrast, the judges on the new patent court, named the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, were appointed by the president. Reagan stuffed its bench with corporate patent lawyers and conservative legal scholars, influenced by the Johnny Appleseed of the law and economics movement, Robert Bork. Prior to 1982, federal district judges rejected around two-thirds of patent claims. The Court of Appeals has since decided two-thirds of all cases in favor of patent claims. Reagan's first appointee, Pauline Newman, was the former lead patent counsel for the chemical firm FMC. The Supreme Court also contributed to the industry's 1979-1981 run of wins. When Reagan entered office, one of the great scientific legal unknowns involved the patentability of modified genes. Similar to the uncertainty around the post-war antibiotics market, settled in the industry's favor by the 1952 Patents Act, the uncertainty threatened the monopoly dreams of the emergent biotechnology sector. The U.S. Patent Office was against patenting modified genes. In 1979, its officers twice rejected an attempt by a General Electric microbiologist to patent a modified bacterium invented to assist in oil spill cleanups. The GE scientist, Ananda Chakrabarty, sued the patent office. And in the winter of 1980, Diamond v. Chakrabarty landed before the Supreme Court. In a 5-4 decision written by Warren Berger, the court overruled the U.S. Patent Office and ruled that modified genes were patentable, as was anything under the sun that is made by man. The decision was greeted with audible exhales by the players in the By-Doyle Alliance. Chakrabarty was the game-changer that provided academic entrepreneurs and venture capitalists the protection they were waiting for, says economist Onur Tulum. It paved the way for a more expansive commercialization of science. But the industry knew better than to relax. It understood that political victories could be impermanent and fragile, and it had the scar tissue to prove it. Uniquely profitable, uniquely hated, and thus uniquely vulnerable, the companies could not afford to forget that their fantastic post-war wealth and power depended on the maintenance of artificial monopolies resting on dubious, if not indefensible, ethical and economic arguments that were rejected by every other country on Earth. In the United States, home to their biggest profit margins, danger lurked behind every corner in the form of the next crusading senator, eager to train years of unwanted attention on these facts. Not even By Doyle, that precious newborn legislation, could be taken for granted. This mode of permanent crisis was validated by the return of a familiar menace in the early 1980s. Of all things, it was the generics industry, an old but weak enemy of the patent-based drug companies that reappeared and threatened to ruin their celebration of achieving dominance over every corner of medical research and the billions of public dollars flowing through it. As late as the 1930s, there was no generic drug industry to speak of. There were only big drug companies and small ones, some with stature, others obscure. They both sold products that were, in the parlance of ethical medicine, non-proprietary. To be listed in the United States Pharmacopoeia and National Formulary, the official Bibles of prescribable medicines, drugs could only carry scientific names. The essential properties of a good scientific name, according to the first edition of the Pharmacopoeia, were expressiveness, brevity, and dissimilarity. The naming of drugs and medicines formed the other half of the patent taboo. Branding a drug evidenced the same knavishness and greed as monopolizing one. The rules of ethical marketing did permit products to include an institutional affiliation, Park Davis Cannabis Indica Extract, or Squibb Digitalis Tincture. But the names of the medicines themselves, Cannabis Digitalis, did not vary. The generic name emerged as a parallel form of social property belonging to all that resisted commodification and thereby came to occupy a central place in debates about monopoly rights, writes Joseph Gabriel. As with patents on scientific medicine, the Germans gave the U.S. drug industry early instruction on the use of trademarks to entrench market control. Heuschenbayer broke every rule of so-called ethical marketing, aggressively advertising their breakthrough drugs under trademarks like aspirin, heroin, and Novocaine. The idea was to twine these names and the things they described in the public mind so tightly the brand name would secure a de facto monopoly long after the patent expired. The strategy worked, but the German firms did not reap the benefits. The wartime Office of Alien Property redistributed the German patents and trademarks among domestic firms who produced competing versions of aspirin, creating the first branded generic. During the patent taboo's extended death rattle of the interwar years, more U.S. companies waded into the use of original trademarks to suppress competition. As they experimented with German tactics to avoid genericide, the loss of markets after patent expiration, they were enabled by court decisions that transformed trademarks into forms of hard property, similar to the way patents were reconceived in the 1830s. After World War II, branding and monopoly formed the two-valve heart of a post-ethical growth strategy. The industry's incredible post-war success, between 1939 and 1959, drug profits soared from $300 million to $2.3 billion, was fueled in large part by expanding the German playbook. While branding monopolies with trade names, the industry initiated campaigns to ruin the reputations of scientifically identical but competing products. The goal was the scandalization of generic drugs, writes historian Jeremy Green. The drug companies worked methodically to moralize and sensationalize generic dispensing as a dangerous and subversive practice. Dispensing a non-branded product in place of a brand-name product was cast as counterfeiting. The act of substituting a cheaper version of a drug at the pharmacy was described as beguilement, connivance, misrepresentation, fraudulent, unethical, and immoral. As with patenting, it was the drug companies that dragged organized medicine with them into the post-ethical future. As late as 1955, the AMA's Council on Pharmacy and Chemistry maintained a ban on advertisements for branded products in its journal. That changed the year Equinil hit the market, opening the age of branded prescription drugs as a leading source of income for medical journals and associations. Clinical journals and newer throwaway promotional media now teemed with advertisements for terramycin, Premarin and Diaril rather than oxytetracycline, Pfizer, conjugated equine estrogens, Wyeth, or chlorothiazide, Merck, writes Green. In 1909, only 1 in 10 prescription drugs carried a brand name. By 1969, the ratio had flipped, with only 1 in 10 marketed under its scientific name. In another echo of the patent controversy, the rise of marketing and branded drugs produced division and resistance. By the mid-1950s, an alliance of so-called nomenclature reformers arose to decry trademarks as unscientific handmaidens of monopoly and call for a return to the use of scientific names. These reformers, doctors, pharmacists, labor leaders, made regular appearances before the Kefauver Committee beginning in 1959. Their testimony on how the industry used trademarks to suppress competition informed a section in Kefauver's original bill requiring doctors to use scientific names in all prescriptions. The proposed law reflected the norms that reigned during ethical medicine's heyday and would have allowed doctors to recommend firms but not their branded products. Like most of Kefauver's core proposals, however, the generic clause was excised. The only trademark-related reform in the final Kefauver-Harris amendments placed limits on companies' ability to rebrand and market old medicines as new breakthroughs. With the passage of Medicare and Medicaid in 1965, prescription drug costs became a federal and state budget issue. Calls for generic substitution laws grew louder, and in 1967, Louisiana's Russell Long and New Mexico's Joseph Montoya championed a Senate bill to amend the Social Security Act to require and incentivize generic substitution. The bill failed, but the issue lived on. In May 1967, Wisconsin's Gaylord Nelson opened a decade of hearings on drug industry practices in the familiar setting of the Senate Subcommittee on Antitrust and Monopoly. Nelson's hearings began where Kefauver had left them, directly over the target of patents and trademarks. This is a shocking business, he told the chamber. I don't know of any other area in the marketplace where competing items are available and where this kind of price disparity would last one day. It wouldn't last a day in this case either if the consumer knew the whole story. The Nelson hearings put the nomenclature reformers back into public view. One of the hearings' revelations involved how the drug companies had subverted the original goal of scientific naming, simplicity and easy recall, by purposefully choosing complex, overly syllabic names that were unpronounceable by design. This touched a nerve with the public and became something of a cultural punchline. A 1969 New Yorker cartoon depicted a woman telling her pharmacist, "No expensive brand names, if you please. Just give me a few milligrams of phenylpropanolamine hydrochloride with a touch of chlorpheniramine maleate added." The AMA and the drug companies weren't smiling. They launched an initiative to preempt state-level generic substitution laws across the country, led by state AMA chapters provided with scripts from the national office that scandalized generics as threats to public health. The drug companies, meanwhile, turned to the longtime communications guru, Arthur Sackler, to orchestrate a campaign highlighting the alleged dangers of drug counterfeits and the fallacy of generic equivalents. The efforts enjoyed a success as rapid as it was complete. By 1970, all 50 states had passed anti-substitution laws. The campaign anticipated the 50-state-house strategy of the corporate-funded American Legislative Exchange Council, founded in 1973 with pharmaceutical industry contributions. At the same time, the companies exercised leverage at the highest levels of federal power. In August 1969, the New York Times ran a front-page story about John Adriani, a supporter of generic prescribing, whom President Nixon's FDA chief planned to appoint director of the agency's Bureau of Medicine. Sources told the Times that Nixon quashed the appointment because industry opposition was too great for the administration to bear. Adriani told the paper, "It's a sad commentary when the pharmaceutical industry doesn't let the commissioner of the FDA appoint his man to protect the public." The substance of the industry campaign to discredit generics, however, was bogus. According to expert testimony by the editorial board of the National Formulary and the United States Pharmacopoeia, biological inequivalence, differences in the way two chemically identical drugs operate in the body, had been detected in only a small handful of generic drugs compared to their branded equivalents. One of the experts, Dr. Edward Feldman, said he would be hard-pressed to name more than even a few, less than five, well-conducted, clinically acceptable studies which have demonstrated significant differences between two or more products clinically where they have met all of the chemical and physical standards as provided by the official compendia. He noted that similar differences were sometimes found within the same batch of any drug, branded or not, saying, "From a technical standpoint, there really is no such thing as a complete drug equivalence." The industry responded to evidence that generic drugs were not inherently inferior to branded drugs in a strange fashion, by conceding the point. As William C. Gray, the public relations head of the Pharmaceutical Manufacturers Association, explained to Nelson's committee in 1974, there is really no such thing as a generic drug, just different drugs of different merits that reflect the reputation of the manufacturer. If this was true, then the company should have welcomed a return to the days of squib digitalis tincture. They didn't, of course, because branding twinned to monopoly multiplied the power of each. If they could not win on the superiority of branded drugs, they would die defending their right to profit from the corruption necessary to maintain the illusion. The industry beat back Nelson's mid-decade push for national generic substitution legislation, but again failed to bury the issue. In 1976, the FTC launched a probe into the AMA-orchestrated state-level industry AMA anti-substitution laws, concluding that they impose substantial unwarranted costs on consumers by unduly restricting price competition in the multi-source prescription drug market. A more definitive judgment was delivered by the Alliance of Consumer Groups, Organized Labor, and the AARP that overturned the anti-substitution laws in 40 states. The successful pushback operation hastened a reckoning with a larger failure. The right to prescribe generics has meaning only to the extent generic drugs are available on the market to prescribe. Toward this rub, the battle now turned. The drug companies feared senators. They feared the consumer movement. They feared the AFL-CIO and the AARP. They feared the FTC, the FDA, and the general public they served. One thing they did not fear was the generics industry. Small, underfunded, and poorly organized, the country's off-patent drug companies lacked even a trade association to speak on their behalf when Nelson began his hearings on generic substitution in 1969. The vast majority of generic manufacturers were family businesses into the 1980s, says Alfred Engelberg, the founding counsel for the Generic Pharmaceutical Industry Association. Of the eight companies in the Generic Trade Association in 1980, five or six of them were Jewish families in the greater New York area. The husbands had chemistry degrees and made the drugs while their wives managed the books. They couldn't afford the FDA trial requirements, so it created perpetual natural monopolies for the big drug companies, who could continue charging obscene prices on branded drugs with expired patents and no threat of generic competition. The generics industry took its first steps toward mobilizing on its own behalf in the mid-1970s. Helping them was a crusading ex-Kefauver committee staffer named William Haddad. In meetings in New York and Washington, Haddad coached the ragtag group of generics executives into a Bad News Bears-style underdog counter-drug lobby. The focus of their efforts? Reforming the FDA drug application process to lower the barriers to generics entering the market. The group gained traction in Congress throughout the early 1980s, led by a California Watergate baby named Henry Waxman, who became Haddad's closest ally. By 1983, there was broad support for streamlining the FDA drug approval process, last updated in 1970, so that generic drug manufacturers only had to prove their products performed the same as branded drugs once in the body, known as bioequivalents. To move the issue forward in the Senate, Waxman teamed up with Utah Republican Orrin Hatch. The two found support in both chambers, suggesting the Nelson hearings had prepped the political ground for generics reform, so long as the bill did not touch the political third rails of patents and mandatory substitution. Framed as pro-competition and budget-serious, the bipartisan drive to reform the FDA process was a slow-moving knuckleball for an industry used to fastballs. For decades, it had maintained that patents and monopolies were the only drivers of progress, but the Waxman-led effort to update FDA rules left both untouched. It imposed no new regulations on the brand-name industry. On what grounds, then, were the drug companies opposed? Was the Progress Clause not premised on the eventual diffusion of new knowledge once the patent term had expired? Lacking answers to these questions, the companies responded by grabbing what they could out of a bad situation. As if by instinct, they started talking, apropos of nothing, about patents, specifically longer drug patents. If the generics industry was going to get an abbreviated path to market, they demanded a longer term of exclusivity. In July 1981, the industry's friends in the Senate introduced a bill to extend drug monopolies from 17 to 24 years. The industry argued that new drug patents were entitled to longer life to compensate for the time lost in obtaining FDA approval, says Engelberg. It was a nonsensical claim. Whether a patented product is ever sold, for how long, and under what circumstances, is governed by a host of commercial factors. A patent does not create an affirmative right to sell a patented product at all, let alone for the life of the patent. After the bill passed the Senate and moved to the House, Engelberg said as much before Tennessee House Democrat Al Gore's Committee on Science and Technology. The claim that patents create an affirmative right to sell a product at all, let alone for a given amount of time, has no legal basis, Engelberg testified. A patent only grants the right to exclude others from selling that product during its term. In an unrigged free market, the public is entitled to the benefit of competition from lower-cost generic drugs without paying for that right by granting longer monopolies to brand-name drugs. When the patent extension bill came within 5 votes of passing the House, the two sides agreed to negotiate. It was clear that longer drug monopolies would be the political price for permitting the abbreviated generic drug approval process, Engelberg recalled decades later. The original proposal to trade patent term extension for the expedited generic approval was developed by Waxman in late 1983 and early 1984. Haddad served as the principal negotiator for the generic side. The resulting compromise bill formalized the trade-off. The FDA would approve generic drugs that demonstrated bioequivalence without independent proof of safety and efficacy, and patented drugs would be eligible for an extra 5 years of market exclusivity. The deal included a last-minute sweetener for the brand-name companies. 10 years of additional market exclusivity for all drugs introduced between 1982 and the bill's passage in September 1984, just to make sure their projected earnings for the decade were not adversely affected, says Engelberg. The Drug Price Competition and Patent Term Restoration Act of 1984, better known as Hatch-Waxman, was controversial among the drug majors. Some companies were furious at their colleagues for not fighting the low-born generics industry to the death on principle. The hardline bloc was led by Hoffman LaRoche, the U.S. division of the Roche Group based in Basel, Switzerland, a country that did not issue drug patents until 1977. In the wake of the bill's passage, Hoffman La Roche's CEO, Erwin Lerner, is said to have personally orchestrated the removal of the Pharmaceutical Manufacturers Association's president, Lou Engman, for the crime of conspiring with the enemy. What kind of industry can weather the rise of competition that undercuts its prices by 65% on products accounting for 40% of its market, and not only maintain its profit margins, but actually increase them? An industry with monopoly control of the remaining 60%. In the 6 years after Hatch-Waxman, a flood of non-branded drugs entered the market and forced prices down on de facto prescription drug monopolies. Yet aggregate spending on prescription drugs increased over the same time frame because the drug companies responded by jacking up prices on products still protected by the now expanded monopoly term. The drug companies wiped out the country's savings on generics in two ways. In the near term, it simply raised prices. Next, it went to work innovating anti-competitive practices that remain standard operating procedure. The bluntest of these methods are pay-to-delay, where brand-name companies grease the palms of generic firms to delay their generic FDA applications, and the blow-off, in which the big companies refuse to provide samples and otherwise block necessary information from being available to scientists at generic companies. This latter strategy was connected to the industry drive to strengthen legal protections around undisclosed information in the Uniform Trade Secrets Act of 1985, a subject of this book's final chapter. Post-Hatch-Waxman, the drug companies also put new energy behind developing the patent law practice known as evergreening. This is when a company that is facing a patent cliff, usually on a blockbuster drug, artificially resets the patent term, sometimes more than once, by submitting a new application based on extremely minor or cosmetic tweaks to the original product, or on advances in the manufacturing method made during the first patent term. By going back to the well, the companies erect barriers to the arrival of generics without increasing the therapeutic value of the drug under extended patent protection. In many cases, new patent terms have been granted for changing the color of a drug or tweaking the language on the label. Even the most outrageous and legally vulnerable evergreening tricks serve a purpose by raising the cost of entry to competitors, who must either file and fight an expensive challenge or proceed with manufacture at the risk of being targeted with an infringement suit by a multinational company with bottomless resources and a field army of patent lawyers. The rise of evergreening was captured in a first-of-its-kind study published in 2021 by Robin Feldman, director of the Center for Innovation at the University of California Hastings College of the Law. Using 13 years of patent data beginning in 2005, Feldman built a database that shows how pharmaceutical companies have deployed minor tweaks and marketing rebrands to prolong patents and delay generic competition. Many of the deftest practitioners of the art are the same companies posing as heroes for their roles during the COVID-19 pandemic. AstraZeneca leads the pack with 6 drugs among the top 20 with the most additional protections, providing an additional 90 years of monopoly on drugs that treat common diseases such as diabetes. Johnson & Johnson has been granted 167 protections on 14 patents related to its HIV drug, Prezista, effectively delaying generic competition for 16 years over the original patent term. Gilead is using similar tactics to artificially extend monopolies on the HIV drugs Truvada and Viread. Feldman identified a mutation of evergreening that she calls product hopping, in which modified versions of already evergreen products are rolled out to restart the clock yet again. Look at the way AstraZeneca product hopped Prilosec to become Nexium, with all of the protections piled onto Nexium. They are essentially evergreening their evergreens. Patents are supposed to come to an end. They are intended as time-limited government grants of market protection to incentivize the innovation of new life-saving medicines, says Feldman. But that's not what we are seeing. The database shows how the industry takes advantage of the patent system by blocking competition to protect their prices and revenue. These drug tweaks may be enough to get these companies past the patent office, but they may not mean much in terms of a benefit to patients. Society is lavishing expensive rewards on minimal improvements. Feldman's findings reinforce a 2018 study by the research group IMAC that showed the 12 top-selling prescription drugs in 2017 had an average of 38 years of patent protection designed to block generic competition. This is nearly double the 20-year monopoly intended under U.S. patent law, says Tahir Amin, the group's co-executive director. Over half of the top 12 drugs in America have more than 100 attempted patents per drug, and prices have increased 68% on average since 2012 for 11 of these 12 drugs. These figures reflect an explosion in patenting rates. Between 2005 and 2015, the number of pharmaceutical patents granted in the U.S. more than doubled. In 1985, Engelberg left his law firm to work full-time challenging the validity of branded drug monopolies. He used some of the proceeds to found an institute for the study of innovation and intellectual property at the New York University School of Law. I told the Gore Committee in 1982 that extending drug monopolies will produce higher prices and less innovation, says Engelberg. That's exactly what happened. An ongoing payoff to a highly profitable industry has wiped out the savings generic drugs should have produced. Generics now fill 90% of U.S. prescriptions, but we're still spending up to 3 times more on prescription drugs than other developed countries. Why? Because the remaining 10% account for 80% of all prescription drug spending, and no other developed nation allows pharmaceutical manufacturers to abuse their monopoly power by price gouging. In 2010, a Democratic Congress passed a Hatch-Waxman look-alike bill called the Biologics Price Competition and Innovation Act. It replicated the Hatch-Waxman trade-off, establishing expedited approval for generic biologic drugs in exchange for giving companies new pathways to delay competition and defend market exclusivity, which the bill guarantees for 12 years. AIDS broke through to widespread public consciousness in 1985. It was the year of Rock Hudson and Ryan White, the year of the first reliable test for HIV antibodies. At a press conference on September 17th, the President of the United States said the word AIDS for the first time. Reagan proclaimed the epidemic a top priority for his administration, even as it prepared a budget for 1986 that cut AIDS research funding by 11%. In April of that year, a play opened off-Broadway at New York's Public Theater that cast a literal spotlight on the administration's miserable response. The 12th scene of Larry Kramer's autobiographical play, The Normal Heart, finds Dr. Emmer Bruckner, a crusading AIDS researcher, alone in her wheelchair on an otherwise dark stage. Told that her request for an AIDS research grant has been denied on budget grounds, she delivers a wrathful monologue aimed at unseen government officials. $5 million doesn't seem quite right for some 2,000 cases. The government spent $20 million investigating 7 deaths from Tylenol, she says. We are now almost into the third year of this epidemic. Your National Institutes of Health received my first request for research money 2 years ago. The paltry amount of money you are making us beg for, from the $4 billion you are given each and every year, won't come to anyone until only God knows when. Anyway you add all this up, it is an unconscionable delay, and has never, never existed in any other health emergency during this entire century, while something is being passed around that causes death. We are enduring an epidemic of death. Kramer's rage at the Reagan administration was well-targeted, but perhaps too narrow. The failure to fund AIDS research extended to a private drug sector that no longer cared about infectious disease. Such diseases weren't eradicated after World War II. Tuberculosis and dozens of tropical viruses killed and maimed tens of millions of people every year, but they were increasingly marginal to the interests of an industry focused on blockbuster prescription drugs and chronic disease treatments targeting the richest markets. As recently as 1967, dozens of U.S. companies maintained infectious disease divisions and vaccine manufacturing facilities. The rapid disappearance of both became an issue of official concern at the end of the 1970s, on the cusp of the first reports of an unusual and fatal pneumonia spreading through San Francisco's gay community. The apparently diminishing commitment and possibly capacity of the American pharmaceutical industry to research, develop, and produce vaccines may be reaching levels of real concern, concluded a 1979 report by the Office of Technology Assessment. 6 years later, the nonprofit Institute of Medicine warned that the industry's vanishing investments in infectious disease threaten the nation's ability to address future epidemics, and possibly to suppress those already thought to be eradicated by science. Reliance on market incentives to ensure vaccine availability may lead to a failure to meet public health needs and may not result in optimal levels of vaccine innovation, concluded the Institute. The industry did not dispute the economic logic driving the disinvestment. In an address to Congress in 1986, the president of Merck, Douglas McMaster said that his company might be forced to close down one of the industry's last major infectious disease and vaccine programs due to the profitability of such products. The stigma surrounding AIDS only reinforced the industry's decision to keep its money at a safe distance from the new disease. 3 years into the epidemic, not a single pharmaceutical firm had announced a research project to crack its mysteries or develop a cure or treatment. This intensified a sense of obligation in some quarters within the federal research establishment, which was never quite the apathetic bureaucratic monolith depicted in Kramer's dramatization. Within the National Cancer Institute and the National Institute of Allergic and Infectious Diseases, senior figures understood they would have to take the lead in a less than hospitable political climate. The key figure was Samuel Broder, the newly appointed 40-year-old head of the Cancer Institute's Clinical Oncology Program. Of the many NIH institutes, NCI was best positioned to develop experimental treatments in-house. For half a century, it had been amassing an archive of drug candidates drawn from thousands of federally funded projects across the country. It is the only group at the NIH that actually had become a pharmaceutical company working for the public, in difficult areas where the private sector either could not or would not make a commitment, Broder explained in an official NIH history. Following the 1984 identification of HIV as the virus that causes AIDS, Broder and a team of NIAID and NCI researchers developed a system for measuring the effectiveness of experimental molecules in blunting HIV's potent attack on white blood cells. They then deployed the test to screen candidate drugs stored at research centers in a dozen states. Hundreds failed the test before one showed promise. Zithromycin, or AZT, an anti-cancer drug developed at Wayne State University and the Detroit Cancer Institute during the 1960s and 70s using NCI grants. The drug was abandoned as a dead end in 1974 after it proved incapable of reversing the growth of tumors. But the test developed by Broder demonstrated AZT's activity against an enzyme that drives the replication of HIV. When the normal heart premiered in late April 1985, Broder's team was finalizing preparations for the first human trial. With a promising candidate molecule in hand, Broder began a search for an industry partner to co-develop and eventually manufacture the drug. He did not find any takers. The self-proclaimed defenders and champions of public health, the brave risk-taking firms who drive and deliver innovation, none of them wanted anything to do with a government effort to address the exponentially growing epidemic. As Broder later explained to the Washington Post, the companies weren't sure it would be worth the financial risk and the risk of having live viruses around. We needed companies to see that there was money to be made here. The first candidate to nibble at the government tender was the U.S. subsidiary of the British drug giant Burroughs Wellcome. It seemed like a good fit. The company had a virology program attached to a modern laboratory just off the Duke University campus, but the company was hesitant to sign a contract that would obligate its researchers to handle AIDS samples. To entice the company off the sidelines, Broder offered anything he could, telling the company, "My entire lab is at your disposal." In exchange for its cooperation, the NCI would lend the company staff and pay the costs of trials. Even after signing on as the contractor, the company held the AZT project at arm's length. They refused to accept live virus and at one point refused to accept patient samples, Broder later recounted. They basically put the entire onus for the Phase 1 pharmacokinetics and related issues on NCI. During the preparations for the initial trial, the company's bureaucracy blocked an internal transfer of a key AZT ingredient, thymidine. The NCI kept things on schedule by shipping its own supply of thymidine across the country to the Burroughs Wellcome factory. When the trials began, government staff conducted all the testing on hospitalized AIDS patients. The public learned of the first trial results the following summer in July 1986, when the New England Journal of Medicine published trial data. The article was followed by growing rumors of a fast-track FDA approval that could have AZT on the market as early as winter. AIDS patients weren't the only community heartened by the news. Overnight, Burroughs Wellcome became the single most attractive major capitalization recommendation of pharmaceutical companies based anywhere in the world, one Wall Street analyst told the New York Times. AZT was a front-page medical story, not a patent story. If anyone was thinking about the patent, they likely assumed the government owned it. And why wouldn't they? The government had invented and rediscovered the drug, then overseen its development as an AIDS treatment, up to and including the management of human trials. In March 1987, the government announced a plan to distribute $100,000 worth of the drug on an emergency basis and launched a public information campaign to make doctors aware of the novel treatment. But the government did not own the rights to the drug. The same day the FDA granted fast-track authorization of AZT, Burroughs Wellcome announced the cost of a year-long course at between $8,000 and $12,000. Before it hit the market, the first AIDS drug became the most expensive drug in the history of the world. Most insurance plans did not cover drugs at the time, effectively pricing out many of the estimated 1.5 million Americans infected with the virus. As with branded hepatitis C drugs 30 years later, the price threatened to snap Medicaid and Medicare budgets already straining under Reagan's budget cuts. It also became an early rallying cry for the young New York City activist group, ACT UP, the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, whose members organized a series of direct action protests and blockades targeting the Food and Drug Administration Federal Building, Burroughs Wellcome's corporate offices, and the New York Stock Exchange. The group drew national attention to the pricing scandal, but Burroughs Wellcome held on tight to its patent. The company evinced no sign it intended to license competition. The government showed no sign of doing anything about it. How did this happen? From the start of AZT's development process, the government could have claimed ownership of the invention under the public health provisions of the Bayh-Doyle Act. This would have allowed the NIH to license multiple manufacturers and drive down the price and even produce the drug itself. That was the first of multiple possible fail-safes. When the price was announced, the government could have invoked its march-in power under Bayh-Doyle, or the U.S. Code governing patents, or the Constitution's takings clause to authorize competition. Instead, it did nothing. When legislators and AIDS patients demanded to know why Burroughs Wellcome had been allowed to claim exclusive rights on a drug developed almost entirely in the public sector, the government played dumb. Assistant Secretary of Health and Human Services Lowell T. Harmison, who oversaw the AZT project, said the agency's plan to claim the patent and produce a competitive AZT market had been stymied by the speed of his contractor. Burroughs got there first, he told the Washington Post. In the same interview, he described the AZT program as a successful example of the way the capitalist system is supposed to work. Broder fell into line. The Burroughs Wellcome price was not something anyone could have anticipated, he told the Post in 1987. We didn't pick up fast enough on the cost issue. This was an absurd comment from a top official at the very heart of the post-Bayh-Doyle federal health bureaucracy. 8 years of patent and tech transfer reforms had been designed to produce precisely this outcome. The law at the center of the AZT joint project, the Technology Innovation Act of 1980, better known as Stevenson-Wydler, expanded in 1986, included very detailed instructions for greasing the transfer of patentable knowledge to the private sector, but said nothing about reasonable pricing or ensuring access in the public interest. Bayh-Doyle's march-in was the nearest tool it had to override the patent, but as its architects later admitted, it was not intended to actually work that way. Days after Burroughs Wellcome's scandalous price announcement, Henry Waxman announced an investigation into the AZT patent by the House Subcommittee on Health and the Environment. The hearing showed the company's price justifications to be nonsense. They were based on projected costs, including opportunity costs incurred by taking on the project, that were dwarfed by expected profits upward of $100 million in the remaining months of 1987 alone. When pressed to explain the markup, company executives turned to a time-honored industry tactic for deflecting price questions. They talked instead about their company's compassionate use program. The strategy backfired, however, when the discount program touted by Thomas Kennedy, Burroughs Wellcome Vice President for Corporate Affairs, was revealed to be limited to trial participants and less than 50 people dying of AIDS. Kennedy maintained that his company bore no social responsibility for making AZT accessible. In one of the banner statements of the Bayh-Doyle decade, he suggested it was the responsibility of governments to subsidize the purchase of the drug from Burroughs Wellcome. Somewhere, society has a responsibility beyond Burroughs Wellcome to assist in the funding of care for AIDS patients, Kennedy told the committee. Because even if we did everything we could do, we would bankrupt the company. The hearings created pressure on the government to go through the motions of defending the public, but it was a pathetic sort of mimicry. When the NIH challenged Burroughs Wellcome's 6 patents in the Federal Circuit Court, its lawyers let stand the company's assertion that the NIH had merely functioned as a pair of hands in the development of AZT. The government was not prepared to defend its position. It did not want to, Broder later said. The Justice Department seemed very unhappy with the whole litigation and did not put forward, in my view, a spirited defense or sufficient energy and resources. The government, for whatever reason, did not choose to act as an equal in the litigation. The AZT controversy revived fundamental questions posed by generations of patent reformers inside and outside of government. These questions had been hotly debated during the 1979 Bayh-Doyle hearings, yet the press reacted as if they were brand new issues, never before seen in Washington. During the Waxman hearings, the Washington Post asked readers to consider, about 7 years too late, what is the public owed when it supports, through the government, development of a highly profitable product? And how can the government assure, when it cooperates with private enterprise, protection of the public's need for life-saving drugs at reasonable costs? The answer to the second question is stated in the fine print of Bayh-Doyle, requiring that all inventions arising from federally funded research be made available to the public on reasonable terms, and provides that the government can march in on private patent claims to protect the public against non-use or unreasonable use of inventions. The government did not pull the Bayh-Doyle march-in trigger in 1987, or in any year since. Among those who reinforced the misperception that marching in was not an option was Broder himself. "We didn't put strings on at the beginning, and we couldn't do it at the end," he said at the time. "The inability of many people to afford to pay for this drug makes me very sad." Between the end of the Waxman hearings and summer, Burroughs Wellcome reported selling $25 million worth of AZT in a growing market with no competition in sight in 17 years of market exclusivity. That December, succumbing to 8 months of protests and public pressure, the company announced a reduction in the price of a 100-capsule bottle of AZT from $188 to $150. Most AIDS patients continued to struggle to pay for the drug, as they would for the next second of government-developed HIV treatments. In March 1989, a Bayh-Doyle-style reasonable pricing clause was added to the Technology Transfer Act of 1986 that expanded Stevenson-Wadler. The text expressed the NIH's concern that there be a reasonable relationship between the pricing of a licensed product, the public investment in that product, and the health and safety needs of the public. Accordingly, exclusive commercialization licenses granted for NIH intellectual property rights may require that this relationship be supported by reasonable evidence. Like the Bayh-Doyle march-in clause that served as its model, the NIH reasonable relationship clause was unused during its short lifespan. In 1996, NIH Director Harold Varmus removed it from the bylaws of the agency's CRADA program. "Enforcement of a pricing clause," said Varmus in announcing the decision, "would divert NIH from its primary research mission and conflict with its statutory mission to transfer promising technologies to the private sector for commercialization." In fact, there is no such statutory mission to commercialize anything, let alone on monopoly terms under Bayh-Doyle or NIH policy. The stated purpose of both its utilization, practical application, a goal that can be achieved through any number of licensing arrangements, including those based on the public ownership of patents. By the time Varmus made this statement, NIH policy was no longer Broder's concern. He had moved into the private sector to become the medical director at Celera, the so-called Microsoft of biology, known for its founder's quest to sequence, patent, and commercialize the human genome. Given Broder's role in the AZT scandal, he could not avoid being asked to answer for Varmus's decision. Shortly after he left the government to join Celera, an NIH historian pressed Broder for his thoughts on his former agency's decision to self-amputate the public interest provision attached to Stevenson-Wadler. "I think that it is perfectly fine," he replied. "It is simply an expression of the fact that you cannot please everybody. Now that I am in the private sector, I understand a little bit more about these things."